sneaking suspicion that life is more than just a steady passing of days, but there are bigger forces at work. How are we to talk about those bigger forces? The Hebrew people conceived of the big forces as God. And in our first reading, we find the story of the ancient ancestor of the Hebrews, Abraham, feeling that bigger force calling him to make a huge change in the course of his life, to leave it all. He discovers that this force is not impersonal, but personal, intimate, and bound by a promise. Genesis 12, verses 1 to 4. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Our second reading. In our gospel reading, Jesus finds himself in a debate with the leaders about what were the most important commandments of the ancient tradition. Commandments were seen as the important rules or laws we were to follow if we were to relate well and faithfully to God in the world. Jesus points to what he believes to be the core of it all. Love God fully and love your neighbor as yourself. Matthew 22, verses 34 to 46. When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. "Teacher, which commandment in the law is the greatest?" He said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." Now, while the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them a question. "What do you think of the Messiah? Whose son is he?" They said to him, "The son of David." Well, he said to them, "How is it then that David, by the Spirit, calls him Lord, saying, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet'? If David thus calls him Lord, how can he be his son?" No one was able to give him an answer, nor from that day did anyone dare to ask him any more questions. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Been doing some thinking over the last little while about how we offer worship in this place, and the old word for worship is liturgy. And liturgy, in its origin, literally means the work of the people. And I spend a lot of time working on the work of the people every week and trying to prepare. But it is nothing if we don't enter into it, this thing we do here in worship. Just like with the children, like that song is waiting there. And it's waiting there for us to pour whatever it is we have in our hearts into it. And it's only then that it becomes worship. I've been thinking about, and I'll talk about this a little later, but about what we do here as a work of art. But it's what we do that helps it be that. In fact, God is the artist, and in fact, what the gathering here is, we are the medium of God's handiwork. So I invite you to kind of step into this song. Be aware of who you are. join me in prayer. Oh God, I have gathered some words here together, and we have gathered ourselves here together. Weave us together and blow your spirit into us, that what we offer here might be acceptable in your sight, for you are our strength and our redeemer. From the sublime to the ridiculous. Are there any fans of the Big Bang Theory here?
Yes.
Anybody?
Yeah.
I've never watched
Big Bang Theory. It's a popular sitcom on TV these days about the exploits of a small group of young adult brainiac scientists and engineers. They live in Pasadena, California. And there's the two roommates. There's Leonard Hofstadter and Sheldon Cooper. Both of them are physicists. There's Penny that lives across the hall. Penny, who it has been a waitress and an aspiring actress. And then there's Leonard and Sheldon's brainiac and geeky and socially awkward friends. There's Howard Wolowitz and an astrophysicist, Raj Kutrapali. That's the kind of the core cast. And the geekiness and the intellect of these four guys is contrast, because it's really funny, with the kind of non-intellectual but down-to-earth and socially quite astute Penny across the street, or across the hall. And although sometimes it's kind of predictable, I just love the way that this show characterizes the way these different quirky characters deal with each other's quirks. But the particular part of the show I want to talk about today is it's all about the roommate agreement. There's this agreement that Sheldon has cooked up, because he was the first guy in the apartment, and when he welcomed Leonard. And it's an agreement that he has written. It's a document, the roommate agreement. And he's drafted it, and it governs everything that happens in the apartment. Sheldon is, set in his ways. A little resistant to change, actually completely resistant to change, and surprise, and anything unpredictable of any kind. The roommate agreement is intended to control his world. Like when Leonard has his girlfriend over, which is not completely covered by the roommate agreement. So things can happen that make Sheldon uncomfortable when the girlfriend comes over. But the roommate agreement governs when you eat, who gets what time in the bathroom, and when. And it's written by Sheldon for the benefit of Sheldon in every possible situation, because he's a bit of a control freak. And then when Sheldon actually gets a girlfriend himself, early in their dating, she has to sign a relationship agreement. Right? Governing when and how they will get together and what they will do and all that stuff. How they will be together. And some of the best gags in this show are when people break these agreements and you watch what that does to Sheldon. Because it just drives me nuts. Or when unforeseen things happen that has not been written into the roommate agreement. So what do you do if you don't anticipate every possible thing that could happen? And how befuddled and immobilized Sheldon becomes. So, but the fact is that partly Sheldon's right. We do live by agreements. which are spoken, some of which are unspoken. And most of them aren't written down, but some of them are. Anybody ever seen a chore chart? Who empties the dishwasher? Who takes the garbage out? Who scoops the litter box? Maybe even when that might happen? Everything from the little stuff, also to the big things. Most of that stuff isn't written down, but who do you fall back on when things go awry in your family? I bet you there's an agreement. I bet you it's not written down anywhere, but I bet you you know who you fall back on. All of human life in community is actually woven together through agreements of one kind or another. Every relationship is an agreement of some kind. Sheldon's trouble is that he sees relationships as science but not art, when in fact, relationships are both. There is a kind of a, there are kinds of predictable laws of nature that govern relationships and the way relationships will function predictably. I mean, these are the ones that we try to teach our kids, right? Don't hit him because he won't like it. And I know you might want to experiment with that, but I can tell you that that's the way it works. It's predictable. There's a science to it. Putting off your chores does not mean they go away. It just means they come back later. There's a predictability to it. There's a science to it. But other aspects of relationships are far more subjective, and they're subject to change, to the effects of the rising and falling of emotion and external factors. Relationships need stability and regularity, but they're also human things, which makes them unpredictable and subjective and inconsistent. And there's beauty in both the science and the art of it. I mean, Sheldon's right that agreements govern relationships. He might as well have called it the roommate covenant, to put religious language around it. That's the religious language for what he's doing. And those have existed for thousands of years. The first covenant between God and Abraham was, well, it's kind of a soulmate agreement. I will be your God and you will be my people. You leave your home and family, which feels awfully risky. And I will tell you where you will go, and I will go with you on the way. And I will make you a great nation and make your name great and your family great. Deal? Deal. It's an agreement. It's a covenant. The entire history of the Jewish people, from then until now, is a history of the covenant, that soulmate agreement between God and the people. So that when Jesus comes along, they ask him, what's the most important part of the soulmate agreement? What is the greatest of the commandments? Of all of the 613 commandments that exist in the Hebrew tradition, which one is the most important? And he replies, of course, well, it's the love one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind. But he doesn't stop there. He also points to the covenant within the human community and says that the covenant between us is the covenant with God. Love your neighbor as yourself. So from the very beginning, the amazing tapestry of human community has been woven and continues to be woven through the making and keeping of that covenant and others, roommate agreements, relationship agreements. And there's a kind of a sacred artistry to the way that we do this. And it's not like the first commandment is the God commandment and the second commandment is the human commandment. Loving God has human implications. Loving humanity has divine implications. They're woven together. And there's a kind of sacred artistry. And trust, for example, works predictably. It grows as we act dependently with each other. Keep our promises. Trust is the slow weaving together of our lives until eventually there is a quiet knowing that we call trustworthy. But it all happens bit by bit by bit as we make sure that the agreements that we have that we can depend on each other are trustworthy, and lo and behold, over time, it is true. And God is in the midst of that. Joy is experienced as we go through experience together, and God is in the midst of that. Healing slowly happens as we share our brokenness together and recover from the mistakes we make. And we do that together, and the relationship grows, and God is in the midst of that. Over the next few weeks, I want to play with an image of our relationship with each other and with God. Because I believe at the center of our relationship with God is the concept of covenant, the concept of the soulmate agreement. But that is both science and art. Peter Short once said that God is the artist and we are the medium of God's handiwork. God is the artist. We are the medium of God's handiwork. There is an agreement between artist and medium. Think about it. There is an agreement between potter and clay. And clay will work predictably some of the time. Mm-hmm. And clay will do some things that surprise the artist, and that's partly what makes the art so exhilarating. That there is both predictability and surprise. That is true with our relationship with God. God is the artist, we are the medium. So what is, think about that. If your life is a work of art in progress, with new hues being added every day, if your life is a work of God, of art that God is the artist in, with color and texture in your life, with darkness and light in your life, with shape changing in your life every day. Think about your family as a work of art. God is the artist. Your family is the medium of God's artistry. And you're part of that. Think about your marriage, if you are in a marriage. Your relationship with your brothers and sisters. As works of art, they're the medium of God's handiwork. Think about sometimes we are hard and brittle, unyielding. Sometimes we are soft and malleable, easy to conform to the imagination of the divine. Like music, sometimes the song sung through us is a little discordant, a little off key. Voices can be tight and sound harsh. And sometimes it's like the music of the heavens that is sung in your life. God is the artist. Jesse Jackson once said, "You can be as crooked as a saxophone, but God is still able to blow a beautiful note through you." That's what I mean. God is the artist. This week, our nation had the challenge of incorporating into our collective psyche ghastly and senseless acts of violence in Quebec and in Ottawa, at our national war memorial, in our parliament. And it was a shock to the system. We don't see ourselves as a nation where that kind of thing happens. And we've been trying to figure out what it means. The way I see it, the national covenant, the national agreement about who we are going to be with each other, was violently broken this week. And it affected you and it affected me inside of ourselves, because we have a picture of who we are and how we are with each other, and that's not it. And we have a whole legal and security and law enforcement apparatus to set up to deal with times when we're not living out the covenant. But in the national psyche, we just have an unwritten covenant. And we just don't do that kind of thing here. And I felt a little bit like Sheldon, kind of bewildered when stuff like that happens and it breaks covenant with each other. But it happens somewhat unpredictably and certainly shockingly. But we have other parts of our national agreement with each other that come into play at a time like this and tell us how we will respond to situations like this. And I believe we are the kind of country, our national agreement is that we don't overreact in situations like this. We try to understand before we act so that our actions are in keeping with what's actually going on. We are fundamentally rooted in the power of compassion. So on the whole, I was proud of the way we as a nation and our leaders responded this week when our national covenant was broken. I heard a minimum of inflammatory language. I heard a huge wave of compassion for the victims' families and their friends. I heard people holding back and trying to understand before they jump to conclusions. These are all very Canadian ways of being. Not really written anywhere as such, but they are part of an unspoken national covenant, who we are. And that's the art of it. The art of being Canadian. There's even divinity in that. And here, this place, among us, God, the artist, is at work. He's at work in you, and in me, and in your life, and in my life, in our life together. It's a relationship, a covenant. There are rules, and there is unpredictability. And most of all, there's trust. We don't have a choice in our life whether or not we will play, whether or not we will be a part of the agreement. The fact that we are here means we are in an agreement with the universe, with God. We are in it. We are being molded and shaped in every moment and in every experience. We have character and qualities that form us. The question, really, is how we will engage with God in the art of our own lives. How, in this place, we will engage with God in the art of being Northwood. That's what the next 5 weeks are about. But I invite you to think of your life as a work of God and God as the artist. Julia Cameron, the author of The Artist's Way, uses another art form to express it. She says,